Well, thank you all for coming. Can everybody hear me? First of all, the one thing I'll say is that my job is to declassify and not reclassify tapes. So I'll start that right up front. So I'm going to be fairly informal. I even took my coat off. Hopefully you'll hear more of Richard Nixon than you will of me. He's much more interesting. So on Monday, July 16th, 1973, Richard Nixon's presidency unraveled. On that day, former Nixon administration official, Alexander Butterfield, testifying before the Senate Select Committee on Presidential Campaign Activities, spilled the beans and stunned the nation by revealing that President Nixon had secretly recorded his telephone conversations and meetings. Butterfield went on to state that Nixon had installed listening devices in the Oval Office, in his old executive office building office, in the cabinet room, at Camp David, and on his telephones. Immediately following this disclosure, the Watergate special prosecutor, Archibald Cox, sought access to the tapes. He believed that they would be crucial pieces of evidence in his investigation of the break-in of the Democratic National Committee. President Nixon refused to turn over the tapes, and he sought over the next 12 months to stall the investigation as best he could. He claimed executive privilege in refusing to comply with subpoenas issued by Cox. He fought their release in the courts. He actually fired the Watergate special prosecutor in what became known as the Saturday Night Massacre. And ultimately, he released highly edited versions of transcripts of certain conversations. In short, he did everything he could to prevent these tapes from becoming public. But in late July 1974, the Supreme Court ruled against him unanimously and ordered him to turn over these conversations. So less than a week later, after the court ruled against him, he resigned as president. He resigned shortly after turning over what is now known as the smoking gun conversation. This famous or infamous conversation was recorded on June 23, 1972 by the secretly installed White House recording system, and it captured the president and his chief of staff, H.R. Haldeman, devising a plan to stop the FBI's investigation into the break-in. In this conversation, they planned to have the CIA tell the FBI to, quote, stay the hell out of this, don't go any further. This conversation was a crime. It was a clear obstruction of justice. The transcript of this conversation was released to the public for the first time on August 5th. It caused an immediate uproar. Now everyone who read that transcript could answer Senator Howard Baker's famous question from the Watergate hearings. What did the president know, and when did he know it? Well, the president not only knew about the break-in 6 days after the fact, but he was personally orchestrating the cover-up. Now Democrats and Republicans alike condemned the president. Even the president's staunchest congressional supporters, like Charles Wiggins of California, who had been his principal defender during the judicial impeachment hearings, now called for his resignation. His own vice president, Gerald Ford, reading the transcript for the first time on August 5th, publicly stated that the president's words were impeachable. So Americans have always been fascinated by Richard Nixon. Maybe it's his personality, maybe it's because he resigned. I'd like to think it's because of the tapes. So I'm happy to be here with you today to talk about this very unique and rich collection of records that is at long last available for public research. I'm speaking with Sarah Cunningham from the Johnson Library, and my colleague Maura from the Kennedy Library could not be here with us, but I wanted to say that July 16th, 1973 was a pivotal day, it was a historic day, and our citizens owe Alexander Butterfield a great deal of thanks. And why I say that is because immediately after he spilled the beans about the tapes, the Nixon White House immediately sought to do damage control by exposing the secret taping systems of Presidents Kennedy and Johnson before him, thus leading the way to a very rich collection that we're now able to listen to. For various reasons, only a few historians and journalists have really ventured to our libraries to listen to this treasure. But as our nation increasingly becomes digital and dissemination and use becomes much easier, we archivists are hopeful that more people will take advantage of this incomparable resource and become flies on the wall as history unfolds. I thought I would talk for a few seconds about the Nixon Archives, where I work in Washington, D.C. It's part of the National Archives in the Presidential Library System. In our own unique case, Congress passed special legislation after Nixon resigned, giving the National Archives legal custody of all his papers and tapes created during his presidency. And although Nixon was in office only 5.5 years, his papers actually comprised the third largest presidential collection out of any library. Only Reagan and Bill Clinton have larger collections. In his autobiography, RN, The Memoirs of Richard Nixon, he stated that he wanted his administration to be the best documented in history. It was. We have 46 million pages worth of documents, 500,000 photographs, 700 hours worth of film, 30,000 presidential gifts, 4,000 hours of off-air video recordings, over 4,000 audio records, and most importantly for today, 3,700 hours worth of secretly recorded White House tapes, over 2,000 hours which are now publicly available. I thought I would talk for a few seconds just about Nixon's tapes and the taping system before playing some conversations. Nixon's decision to record began in 1971, February. It was a closely held secret. The Secret Service was tasked with assembling and monitoring this system. Initially, only conversations in the Oval Office and the Cabinet Room were recorded. But even though they had never listened to a single conversation, they decided it was worth expanding, thankfully. So in April 71, it included his hideaway EOB office in the Executive Office Building office and his telephones. And then in May 1972, he expanded the system to include his retreat at Camp David. The Secret Service designed the system very primitively and very cheaply. It cost under $4,000 beginning to end to maintain and assemble. It was voice activated. It was tied to the presidential locator system. By that I mean it only became activated when the president entered a recording location. It was kind of a system that the Secret Service used to keep track of where the president was in the White House at any one time. So when he entered into the Oval Office, the system would become active, and then the minute the microphones picked up sound, it would begin to record. The Secret Service used small lapel-type microphones, placing them in the knee wells of the president's desk, a very unfortunate location for knees knocking, telephone ringing, and pen scribbling. Wires led to a mixer and an automatic gain control, which was supposed to optimize the sound by increasing or decreasing the signal strength depending on the speaker's proximity to the microphone. In practice, this did not work so well, as you will hear. Wires led to Sony 800B recorders. They were timers put on them. It was designed that each recorder would alternate, so that one day one recorder would record, the next day the other one would. The Secret Service did not monitor the sound quality at all. Their sole function once the system was installed was to change the tapes. To minimize the necessity of changing these reels, after all, it was a kind of a dubious duty, they decided to record at a very slow speed of 15/16 of an inch per second using very thin 0.5 mil tape. So as a result, a single tape could record up to 6.5 hours worth of conversations. And they would use whatever tape was available. And in fact, I had a Secret Service agent tell me that, well, if they were running low, they would just run across the street to the drugstore and buy whatever was there. So between February of 1971 and July of 1973, they managed to amass a collection of 950 reels of tape, although six are blank. The total listening time is about 3,700 hours. We have archively processed 2,019 hours that are available today, and we only have one final batch worth of about 1,000 left. I can give you the breakdown of how few we have restricted for national security at a later date, or later this afternoon if you're interested, but it's not much. I thought I would talk very quickly about the evolution of our tapes processing at the archives, and because the technology is unfortunately far outpaced our project as how we originally designed it to do. These dramatic changes have forced us to change how we review, listen to, and preserve these tapes. In a nutshell, archivists like myself review the tapes for content. Using a digital audio tape imprinted with a SMPTE time code, we excise portions as our regulations require, very few, hopefully. Using a SADE digital audio workstations, our technicians then copy the tape as a 24-bit 44.1 wave file onto one audio stream. And it's essential that the SMPTE time code migrate for our editing purposes so that the editors, the technicians can then edit out national security or privacy or unintelligibles that we haven't been able to recover. Note, as you will hear, these tapes are not studio quality at all. The machines malfunctioned. The automatic gain control failed. There is extraneous noise. There's echo. The Oval Office, although a beautiful room, was not ideal for recording as sound bounces across. There is electronic interference from the air conditioning system if it was turned on. And also there was just the normal conversational tone of the conversations of people interrupting one another, or dogs barking outside, or the sirens going. So what does this all mean? This means that our technicians have to evaluate each and every conversation in an attempt to try and enhance the sound quality to improve the intelligibility so that you all here today can hear it. The idea, though, is that we don't want to alter the sound so that Nixon does not sound like Nixon. We really want Nixon to sound like Nixon. At the same time, though, we do use a Cedar-Noors reduction. We use various plugins, such as equalizers, notch filters, compressors. And we've also used intelligent devices, speech enhancement systems, for especially difficult tapes to try to make them more audible. That's as much, I think, as I want to get into, because I think I'd really like to play about 15 minutes worth of Richard Nixon for you. But I'm not actually going to start with Richard Nixon. I thought, because my colleague Maura Porter from the Kennedy Library couldn't be here, I thought I would actually start by playing two Kennedy tapes, and then I'll move into Nixon. And I'm going to focus, at least for the first part of this, on Vietnam and looking at the continuity of the Vietnam War. So the first conversation I'm going to play, it's about 2 minutes long, is after Diem has been assassinated, and John F. Kennedy is entering a memo to the record into his files that he wants typed up. It's 3 days following the assassination, and you'll hear on this that he appears to be blaming the State Department and the U.S. ambassador to Vietnam, Henry Cabot Lodge, Nixon's vice presidential running mate in 1960. So with that, why don't we listen to track one, Kennedy talking about the Diem murder.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Monday, November 4th, 1963. Over the weekend, the coup in Saigon took place. Culminated 3 months of conversation about a coup, comma, conversation which divided the government here and in Saigon. Opposed to a coup was General Taylor, the Attorney General, Secretary McNamara, to a somewhat lesser degree, John McCone, partly because of an old hostility to Lodge, which causes him to lack confidence in Lodge's judgment, partly as a result of a new hostility, because Lodge shifted his station chief. Semicolon, in favor of the coup was State, led by Abel Harriman, George Ball, Roger Hilsman, supported by Mike Forrestal at the White House. I feel that we must bear a good deal of responsibility for it, beginning with our cable of early August in which we suggested the coup. Period. In my judgment, that wire was badly drafted. It should never have been sent on a Saturday. I should not have given my consent to it without a roundtable conference in which McNamara and Taylor could have presented their views. While we did redress that balance in later wires, that first wire encouraged Lodge along a course to which he was in any case, inclined. Hawkins continued to oppose the coup on the ground that the military effort was doing well. There was a sharp split between Saigon and the rest of the country. Politically, the situation was deteriorating. Militarily, it had not had its effect.
So there you have kind of an after-action. He's maybe covering himself a little bit and blaming the State Department. Well, now I'd like to go back 6 days. He is. He is talking directly into the dictaphone machine, and he's writing his memo to the record. So now we're going to go back 6 days, 3 days before the coup and 3 days before Diem is murdered, and he now has an NSC meeting in place, and they're talking about whether they should be supporting the coup. And here the President's brother, Robert, you're going to hear talk about whether the U.S. should play a role. And you'll hear that perhaps there was more of a U.S. role than Kennedy would lead us to believe from this first segment that we just heard. So let's play the second one. Tough to understand, but now we know that both John Kennedy and his brother Robert were definitely much more intricately involved in the coup, in the assassination of Diem, than we would be led to believe if we had just relied on that very first dictabelt conversation. So I think this is a really interesting perspective here. And with that, I'm going to turn to Nixon. And of course, there was nothing that excited Richard Nixon more than having to talk about the Kennedys. So this is a very good transition, I think. This is a conversation, a telephone conversation, between the President and Billy Graham. It was recorded on August 7th, 1971. And Nixon has just finished giving a speech on television, making the case that Operation Lamson, the incursion into Laos by the Army of the Republic of South Vietnam, was successful. So Billy Graham is calling to congratulate Richard Nixon on his speech. And lo and behold, our friend John Kennedy comes up. So let's listen to track three.
Because we're fighting a very tough battle here. You know, everybody wants to pull out, but I have to fight against the tide. I got to do the right thing.
I think you defused a lot of it tonight, though. I don't see how, what in the world they can say after tonight.
I think that you've given some of people like me, you've given me something to hold on to and to really say. And I've got an editorial in the New York Times on Friday, which I wrote this morning. They added
for you
yesterday.
Good.
And I'm putting all the blame of this whole thing on Kennedy.
That's right. He started the damn thing. He killed DM, and he sent the first 16,000 combat people there himself.
Well, I'm saying that the first time I ever heard of our involvement was 4 days before he was inaugurated, playing golf with him. He said, I quote, we cannot allow Laos and South Vietnam to fall to the communists.
So, I'm going to move forward a little bit now to May of 1972. The North Vietnamese have just launched a spring offensive, and Nixon is incensed. So he, here in this conversation, Kissinger and Nixon, Henry Kissinger, his national security advisor, are talking about options, about what to do in response to this offensive. Nixon ultimately decides on a blockade and to mine Haiphong Harbor and to increase bombing in Hanoi. RN, being Nixon, notes that they're high stakes. You're going to hear him say, we must not lose in Vietnam. And he's going to go on television and give a speech talking about this. So this is on the edge of this speech where they announce the decision. He and Kissinger are going to formulate the strategy of what they're going to do. But most importantly, this is a historically important conversation because you do get the full effect of what is believed to be known as the domino theory about why we are there. In addition to that, you'll hear a fairly chilling conversation at the tail end of this talking about the possible escalation to include bombing the dikes in North Vietnam, which of course would have flooded the countryside and killed hundreds of thousands of people. So there is a discussion of that as well. So let's listen to track 4. So Nixon goes on television 2 days later and announces that he is going to mine Haiphong Harbor and begin the blockade and to bomb Hanoi. Immediately following this televised speech, Nixon gets a phone call from one of his very closest and dearest best friends, Bibi Rebozo, congratulating him on his speech. And what follows is a very humorous conversation between two friends.
Well, you know, the question is now whether it works.
Well,
it will work over a period of time, because I intend to squeeze these bastards if it takes a year.
Exactly. Well, I guess they got 3 days to bring everything they want in, haven't they? But
No. Oh, hell no.
One way thing.
Oh no, boy! If they start bringing it in.
Oh, good.
You see, then the ships are stuck.
Well,
so nobody's going to go in.
It's just obvious. They thought
20 ships are lined up to get out right now. They're clocked the channel. There's no way they can get in. Hell no. And we're going to bomb the railroad yards tonight.
Beautiful. Well, I tell you, they just didn't dream that you would do this in election year.
Yeah. Well, it'll of course probably As they've already said, most people think it'll sink the Russian summit, but I don't
think so.
But if it does, what the hell?
I don't think it will. I think they're going to want it all the more.
Well, I don't know.
You didn't say a thing about China. I tell you, it was just a magnificent thing. I've never had such a reaction on anything. Never. My phone was ringing off the hook. And people don't normally call. They might express themselves later. But it was just a phenomenal thing, and the reaction is just...
The call's all male.
I told Bob...
Happened all?
No, I told Bob Haldeman last night. One woman called, and I didn't know whether she was drunk or just emotional, crying. And I don't know who she was. I didn't want to ask her. And how she got my home number, I don't know.
Probably got it off of the wall of some toilet.
I'm going to move forward a little bit to August of 1972 and back to maybe a little bit more seriousness. The president is talking with Henry Kissinger. In there, Henry Kissinger is at this point deeply involved in peace negotiations in Paris. But they're concerned that they might get a peace agreement that comes too soon before the 1972 election, and also one that would possibly, they're afraid that the South Vietnamese government would collapse. And they're afraid that this collapse, if it comes too soon after the peace treaty, would look poorly on Nixon on his and also on U.S. foreign policy. Many historians say this is very tangible evidence that there was a decent interval strategy in Nixon's exit in Vietnam. So I'd like to play this segment. It's about a minute and 44 seconds. So that's the interval, January of 74. When we think about Watergate, we typically always think about the cover-up, the break-in, but really the Watergate investigation was about more than that. It was about abuses of governmental power, including the selling of ambassadorships, illegal wiretaps, investigating your political enemies for your own political gain. So what I wanted to do was play two clips that are evidence of these other abuses, not play the smoking gun, not play the cancer on the presidency. We've all heard those. But I did want to play one. This is the president talking with Richard Kleindienst, the Deputy Attorney General of the United States, in April 1971. And ITT has promised the Republican National Committee about $400,000 for the Republican convention to be held in San Diego the next year. But they need some help on an antitrust suit. In the federal government, Nixon's own Department of Justice is allying itself against the company. So with this in mind, President Nixon calls the Deputy Attorney General of the United States.
Hi, Mr. President.
Hi, Dick. How are you?
Good. How are you, sir?
Fine, fine. I'm going to talk to John tomorrow about my general attitude on antitrust. In the meantime, I know that he is left with you, the IT&T thing, because apparently he says he had something to do with them once. Well, I have nothing to do with them, and I want something clearly understood. And if it is not understood, McLaren's ass is to be out within 1 hour. The IT&T thing, stay the hell out of it. Is that clear? That's an order.
You mean the order is to...
The order is to leave the goddamn thing alone. Now, I've said this, Dick, a number of times, and you fellows apparently don't get the message over there. I do not want McLaren to run around prosecuting people, raising hell about conglomerates, stirring things up at this point. Now, you keep him the hell out of that. Is that clear?
Well, Mr. President...
Or either he resigns. I'd rather have him out anyway. I don't like the son of a bitch.
The question that is...
The question is, I know that the jurisdiction... I know all the legal things, Dick. You don't have to spell out the legal...
...of appeal file.
That's right.
A brief has to be filed tomorrow.
That's right. Don't file the brief.
Your order is not to file a brief.
My order is to drop the goddamn thing. Is that clear?
Yeah, I understand.
Okay.
So I've got one more conversation I'd like to play, and I toyed with the idea of whether I should play this or not, given the immigration debate that our country seems to be having right now. And ultimately, as I said, this is not only an evidence of abuse of power, this is a telephone conversation from October of 1971. And this time, Nixon is actually talking with the Attorney General, John Mitchell. Nixon has just finished reading the LA Times, and he is incensed that their publisher, Otis Chandler, has published an expose on a nominee. Nixon had nominated Romana Bañuelos to be the first Mexican-American treasurer of the United States. It was going to be a historic appointment. However, the Times did an expose that showed that her company had hired illegal immigrants. And then what's worse, they wrote a second story showing that the president, through a contractor at his San Clemente home, had also hired an illegal immigrant. So Nixon is absolutely incensed, and he is calling his attorney general.
Yes, sir. With all your other problems, there's one thing that I want done, and I don't want any argument about it. I want you to direct the most trusted person you have in the Immigration Service that they are to look over all of the activities of the Los Angeles Times, all underlined, and they are to send their teams in to see whether they are violating the wetback thing. Now, let me explain, because as a Californian, I know. Everybody in California hires them. There's no law against it because they are there, because for menial things and so forth. Otis Chandler, I want him checked with regard to his gardener. I understand he's a wetback. Is that clear?
Yes, sir.
I understand. Do it. Give me a report.
Very well, sir.
Okay.
Well, the tapes are a unique source for studying the Nixon era. Often the tapes provide the only account of an event. For example, it is from the tapes that we learned that Nixon intended to fire his vice president, Spiro Agnew, in July 1971 and replace him with John Connally, a Democrat. Nixon went so far as to offer the job to Connally on tape. It was recorded, and Connally turned him down. John Dean wrote a book recently on the appointment of William Rehnquist to be the Supreme Court Justice. Using newly released tapes and documents, he detailed the problems Nixon faced in trying to appoint a woman to the bench. He followed the president's thoughts and decision-making daily as he considered a number of candidates. And then, only one day before his announcement, when Senator Howard Baker failed to return a phone call in time, he opted for Rehnquist instead. And these discussions are only found on the tapes. His presidency ended almost 30 years ago. Watergate, the Vietnam War, and Nixon himself have been the subject of hundreds of books. But the full story of Richard Nixon, the good, the bad, the insightful, it has yet to be told. In an article written for the National Archives on the taping system, H.R. Haldeman, his chief of staff, said, quote, "Historians' digestion of the White House tapes will be long, slow, and tedious, but the tapes are an incomparable source, and the historiography of the Nixon administration will eventually be much richer." So with that, I'm going to invite you all to come and listen to our tapes. And hopefully they will be available a little bit more easily online. But I thank you for your time.
justice. Thank you, John. That was great. It's true that there's so much more to learn and so many more aspects of the president's personalities that can come through the telephone conversations. For the LBJ Library, on January 29, 1973, shortly after his death, one of the longtime staff members transferred control of the collection of telephone recordings to the director of the LBJ Library. At that time, she indicated that it was LBJ's wishes that they would remain closed for research for at least 50 years after his death. This collection currently consists of recordings of telephone conversations primarily made on dictabouts. The first collection was from November 22, 1963 through January 1969, and the corresponding transcripts. In response to the President John F. Kennedy Assassination Records Collection Act of 1992, the staff of the LBJ Library prepared a special series that would open up the beginning. The first series is the day he became president, November 22, 1963, through the end of that year. This is the collection that I wish to share with you today. Keep in mind that all of these were made in that time period, and he's just become president, he's gaining control, and I wanted to just show different aspects of his personality. I have a few pictures up here. For his pre-presidential collection, he made everything on the Edison voice writer. So we have a lot of those in our collection. The first week he was president, he used the IBM belts. And then from the Oval Office, when he gradually moved in, he used the blue dictabelts that most of us are familiar with. First, I want to show some clips that I thought were very interesting. And it kind of shows his different relationships with different women. All of these were made within 10 days of becoming president. First one, he's speaking with Catherine Graham.
Hello, Mr. President.
Hello, my sweetheart. How are you?
Well, I'm fine. Are you?
You know, the only one thing I dislike about this job is that I'm married and I can't ever get to see you. I just hear that sweet voice and it's always on telephone. And I'd like to break out of here and be like one of these young animals down on my ranch, jump a fence.
Be careful what you say. The second one, of course, Jacqueline Kennedy was still living upstairs at the time, and he wrote her a series of letters, and she calls him to thank him.
Mrs. Kennedy, 2191.
Oh, yeah.
Mr. President?
I just wanted you to know you were loved and by so many and so much.
Oh, Mr.
I'm
President,
one of them.
I tried. I didn't dare bother you again, but I got Kenny O'Donnell over here to give you a message, if he ever saw you. Did he give it to you yet?
No.
About my letter that was waiting for me last night?
Listen, sweetie, now, first thing you got to learn, you got some things to learn, and one of them is that you don't bother me. You give me strength.
But I wasn't going to send you in one more letter, and I was
just
scared you'd answer.
Don't send me anything. You just come over and put your arm around me. That's all you do. When you haven't got anything else to do, let's take a walk. Let's walk around the backyard and just let me tell you how much you mean to all of us and how we can carry on if you give us a little strength.
But you know what I wanted to say to you about that letter? I know how rare a letter is in a president's handwriting. Do you know that I've got more in your handwriting than I do in Jack's now?
Oh, what? Well.
And for you to write it at this time and then to send me that thing today of, you know, your cape announcement and everything.
I want you to just know this, that I told my mama a long time ago when everybody else gave up about my election in 48.
Yeah.
My mother and my wife and my sisters and you females got a lot of courage that we men don't have. And so we have to rely on you and depend on you, and you got something to do. You got the president relying on you, and this is not the first one you had. So, So there are not many women, you know, run around with a good many presidents. So you just bear that in mind. You got the biggest job of your life.
He ran around with two presidents. That's what they'll say about me. Okay, anytime.
Goodbye, darling.
Thank you for calling, Mr. President.
Bye,
goodbye.
Sweetie. Do come back.
I will.
Of course, he could take criticism also, and Lady Bird was there to give him positive feedback.
You want to listen for about 1 minute to my critique, or would you rather wait till tonight?
Yes, ma'am. I'm willing now.
I thought that you looked strong, firm, and like a reliable guy. Your looks were splendid. The close-ups were much better than the distance ones.
Well, you can't get them to do it.
Well, I will say this. There were more close-ups than there were distance ones. During the statement, you were a little breathless. And there was too much looking down, and I think it was a little too fast. Not enough change of pace.
Moving on. Of course, they didn't call him Master of the Senate for nothing. He was very persuasive, to say the least. Again, this is within the first 10 days of his presidency. And I wanted to include two quick clips of how he could be persuasive. The first is with Senator Hartke.
I have Senator Hartke.
Vance.
Here you are.
Vance.
Yes, sir.
Can't you help me on this excise tax thing? You're going to wreck this damn bill. We're not going to have any. And they're going to get together this afternoon and try to make a motion to keep all excise taxes in there. And we need your help.
Well, I voted that way.
I know it, and Clint Anderson, though, they all got mad yesterday because y'all screwed up that.
The second one is from Senator Ribicoff.
What they tried to do is, that's why I'm taking the exercise.
Senator Ribicoff on 9-1.
Who?
Senator Ribicoff, 9-1.
Hey.
Can't you go with us on this excise thing and let us get a bill? God damn it, you need to vote with me once in a while, just one time.
Well, look, I made a commitment, Mr. President. Let me say this. The Treasury Department.
They could barely get a word in edgewise, as you could probably tell. I thought I would, of course, balance out John's and put in a few clips about Vietnam. Again, he was newly president, and He had a lot on his mind, and Vietnam was something he was just learning more and more about, and these clips reveal a lot.
What do you think about this Vietnam thing? What I'd like to hear you talk a little bit.
This is with Richard Russell.
Frankly, Mr. President, if you were to tell me that I was authorized to settle it as I saw fit, I would respectfully decline to undertake it. It's the damn worst mess I ever saw, and I don't like to brag. I never have been right many times in my life, but I knew we were going to get in this sort of mess when we went in there, and I don't see how we're going to ever get out without fighting a major war with the Chinese and all of them down there in those rice paddies and jungles. I just don't see it. I just don't know what to do.
Well, that's the way I've been feeling for
it's
6 months.
Our position is deteriorating, and it looks like the more we try to do for them, the less they're willing to do for themselves.
And the second clip is with George Bundy.
I'll tell you, the more I just stayed awake last night thinking about this thing, the more I think of it, I don't know what in the hell. It looks like me we're getting into another Korea. It just worries the hell out of me. I don't see what we can ever hope to get out of there with once we're committed. I believe the Chinese Communists coming into it. I don't think that we can fight them 10,000 miles away from home and ever get anywhere in that area. I don't think it's worth fighting for, and I don't think we can get out. And it's just the biggest damn mess.
It's an awful mess.
And we just got to think about it. I look at this sergeant of mine this morning. Got six little old kids over there, and he's getting out my things and bringing me in my night reading and all that kind of stuff, and I just thought about ordering those kids in there, and what in the hell am I ordering him out there for?
One thing that
is Vietnam worth to me? What is Laos worth to me? What is it worth to this country?
We
got a treaty, but hell, everybody else got a treaty out there.
I admit at times it's like working in a time warp. I'll come home from work and I'll spend my day in the 60s and then all of a sudden I'm in the present time. So sometimes when those telephone recordings are what they do upstairs. I work in the basement on the presidential speeches. And at times when there's something embedded in one of the speeches that just seems out of time, I find that very fascinating. I found one clip where he's talking about the internet.
I believe the time has come to stake another claim in the name of all the people. Stake a claim based upon the combined resources of communications. I believe the time has come to enlist the computer and the satellite, as well as television and radio, and to enlist them in the cause of education. And if we are up to the obligations of the next century, and if we are to be proud of the next century as we are of the past two centuries, we've got to quit talking so much about what's happened in the past two centuries and start talking about what's going to happen in the next century, beginning in 76. So I think we must consider new ways to build a great network for knowledge, not just a broadcast system, but one that employs every means of sending and of storing information that the individual can use. Think of the lives that this would change. The student in a small college could tap the resources of a great university. Dr. Killian had just given me an exciting report of his contact in Latin America as a result of some of the declaration of the presidents at Punta del Este that he's followed through on, and how these presidents are now envisioning the day when they can dedicate 20, 25, or larger percent of their total resources for one thing alone, education and knowledge. Yes, the student in a small college tapping the resources of the greatest university in the hemisphere. The country doctor getting help from a distant laboratory or a teaching hospital. A scholar in Atlanta might draw instantly on a library in New York. A famous teacher could reach with ideas and inspirations into some far-off classroom so that no child need be neglected. Eventually, I think this electronic knowledge bank could be as valuable as the Federal Reserve Bank. And such a system could involve other nations. It could involve them in a partnership to share knowledge and to thus enrich all mankind. A wild and visionary idea? Not at all. Yesterday's strangest dreams are today's headlines, and change is getting swifter every moment. I've already asked my advisors to begin to explore the possibility of a network for knowledge, and then to draw up a suggested blueprint for it.
It was not Al Gore.
It was the signing of the public broadcasting bill. I believe it was in 67, maybe 68. Last September, as I saw the images and events and horrors of Hurricane Katrina unfold, I was reminded of one of the first speeches that I had transferred at the LBJ Library. This one particularly stuck in my mind. It was uncatalogued. Nobody really knew about it. It was just sitting on the shelf. But it stuck in my mind because as audio engineers, we want to make everything sound perfect. And this was the first speech that I came across that I could not make sound perfect. His voice didn't come through. There was just a lot of wind whipping around. But then as I was watching TV about Hurricane Katrina, it all struck me how important these tapes are, and it's for much more than the voice. We'll just play the first couple of minutes of it.
The president's remarks
just at the disaster. Sorry. Just have a little bit more set up. He apologizes for the fact that it took him 2 hours to get down to New Orleans, and he puts all the troubles of the world on his desk to the side because this is very important. Also, this is in the days before bottled water, so he makes a great plea to Dr. Pepper and Orange Crush to get liquids for all the children and the old people there.
The President's remarks at the disaster area in New Orleans, Louisiana, September the 10th, 1965.
Mr. Mayor and my friends of New Orleans, today at 3:00, when Senator Long and Congressman Boggs and Congressman Willis called me on behalf of the entire Louisiana delegation, I put aside all the problems on my desk to come to Louisiana as soon as I could. I have observed from flying over your city how great the catastrophe is that you have experienced. Human suffering and physical damage are measureless. I'm here this evening to pledge to you the full resources of the federal government to Louisiana to help repair as best we can the injury that has been done by nature. Throughout the day, I have talked to Senator Long and Senator Ellender, to Congressman Boggs and Willis, to my friend Jimmy Morrison, Otto Passman, and Congressman Wagner about what has taken place in this great state. As we flew to New Orleans, we discussed the ways and means of putting the compassion of the United States in specific and helpful action. With me are Governor Buford Ellington, in charge of the federal government's Office of Emergency Planning, and whose responsibility it is to make sure that all needs to be done gets done as quickly as possible. Also with me...
As you can hear, he got there so fast the wind still hadn't died down, and he's taking charge. Looks like we're out of time. Thank you very much. Any questions for John and myself?
They were tasked with keeping this, number one, doesn't matter what the what party the president's from. The president is concerned about two things, secrecy and not spending any money. And those were his two instructions, were number one, keep it secret, and number two, don't spend any money. So essentially, the entire taping system was taken out of storage and was excess surplus. So it really was kind of a very antiquated system. Yes, sir.
It might interest you to know that ARST was the first public disclosure of the FDR press conference recordings, because we had an article in the ARST Journal way back in the 1970s that listed recordings available for researchers. And that when comments were made about the Nixon White House tapes by a New York Times columnist, the name escapes me for a second, we wrote in and told him it was not secret. It had been published in the ARST Journal, and he had to make a comment that in calling us an obscure publication. That the only place where it was known that FDR had also had secret recordings that was publicized was in an obscure journal.
And those records are just as interesting as Nixon and Johnson's.
Yes.
Yes, sir.
What are the possibilities of issuing that or publicizing widely that short speech of Johnson's about a knowledge network? I think that would really, that should be in everybody's ears in this world, because all we have are bullshit networks.
It's interesting, as archivists, we can't say, oh, look at this. But we do have the LBJ School of Public Affairs, and they have a wonderful website. So when I come across something like that, this was the director's favorite clip. She said, oh, let's put it up there. And then she sends me copies of different blogs of all these people that discovered this clip, you know, with all their vast research when it's, you know, right on our website.
With that, thank you very much.